calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, Live 365, American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Are the socialists winning? Bernie Sanders, by the way, is almost always with us in this first hour of the program. He will be with us shortly today, in all probability. He's attending a funeral right now. And so once that wraps up, he will be calling into the program. And you can call in and say hi to Bernie Sanders and for the first hour of our program. Because the last day of the week, we always have our Brunch with Bernie segment. And we will get to that. But until that happens, I wanted to talk for a moment about economics. This is such a huge issue. The Nordic countries and Finland. This is from Reuters. This is a Reuters story. Nordic countries with Finland in the lead have some of the world's most competitive economies. What? All the cons out there are going, what? How could that be? What? You're talking about countries that have high taxes. Everybody has health care. Everybody has pensions. Everybody, you know, they have 5 weeks of vacation a year. You have strong labor unions. You have a strong, large middle class. How can it be that these are the world's most competitive economies? So the Geneva-based World Economic Forum did this study. Apart from Finland, four other Nordic nations, Sweden at third, Denmark at fourth, Iceland at seventh, and Norway at ninth, were among the top 10 in terms of global competitiveness. What's going on? What's going on? I got to tell you, what's going on is that the economic royalists that Franklin Roosevelt warned us about, who were taking over during the robber baron era in this country, are taking over again in this country, and they're destroying the competitiveness of America. Franklin Roosevelt, July 27, 1936.
For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things.
And Roosevelt went on to say that these new economic royalists, they say, you know, you can have your elections and you can think that you have something to do with politics, but when it comes to money, comes to how you're paid, when it comes to anything that has to do with the economy, you got no say in it at all.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
And that's what they're saying now. Hey, you know, Walmart wants to have economic slaves. If we want to destroy the middle class, we're going to do away with Davis Bacon, and you work for slave wages down there in New Orleans. That's just fine. Thank you very much. Well, Franklin Roosevelt said, we need to overthrow, using a word from the Declaration of Independence, overthrow this kind of power. He pointed out that just like today, I mean, this is like deja vu all over again. This is July 27, 1936. In Philadelphia, Franklin Roosevelt saying,
these economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
Bingo.
Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. And now it has concentrated itself again. The robber barons are back. And they are back, and they are trying to take back America. I mean, they have, to a large extent. You get Franklin Roosevelt, and here's Rush Limbaugh's thoughts on the subject.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Well, Roosevelt had something to say about the Limbaughs of his day as well.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
And then he points out the flag and the Constitution protect us from economic tyranny as well as mob
rule. But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
And the subjection and the tyranny that he was speaking of in that 1936 speech, this was long before World War II. This was when we were just seeing the edges of the, you know, what Hitler was up to. What he was speaking about was economic tyranny in the United States. Absolutely nothing more or nothing less than economic tyranny. And here now we discover that sure enough, those nations that got put back together again after World War II by those liberal Democrats. You know, keep in mind, Truman, Roosevelt, you know, after World War II, well, Roosevelt was dead by that time, but Truman comes in and with the Marshall Plan and all this stuff, and helps Germany and Japan write their constitutions, put their countries back together, and they wrote right into their constitutions, it is a right of every person to have health care. Now, Truman tried to do that in the United States in 1947. He tried to pass the national health care program, a single-payer national health care program in the United States. Would have put out of business all the health insurance companies. And the Republicans, because they took control of the House and Senate in the 1946 elections, that's it. No. But that was the first attempt to have a national health care system in the United States. So he couldn't do it in the United States. So he did it in Germany. He did it in Japan. He said, I'll show you. It works. And it's spread all across Europe. And Finland and Denmark and Sweden and Norway and all these countries, they all have national health care. In fact, in the Scandinavian countries, everybody has a pension. Everybody has a pension. Not through your employer. You say, oh, well, they have very high taxes. Yes, they have very high taxes. Yep. And everybody has health care. Right now, the average American is paying $10,880 for health insurance. The average insured American. Now, if you replaced our private, paid-for system with a national health care system, if all you'd have to do is say Medicare now extends to every single American. This is one of the reasons why the cons are so aggressively trying to destroy Medicare, because this is the kind of threat Medicare represents. If you simply said Medicare now covers everybody, period, no exceptions, everybody's covered by it, your taxes would go up, sure. They'd go up by probably about $3,000 a year. But the amount that you're paying for health care, it would go down by $10,000 a year. Why the big difference? Well, because the health insurance companies wouldn't be taking a piece out of your hide. And this is what every other country in the world has figured out. The Geneva-based World Economic Forum set the United States after Finland in its annual competitiveness league, but recorded growing business concern over the Bush administration's handling of the government's finances. Study was based on hard economic data and business opinion surveys in 117 countries. It says Northern European nations are challenging the conventional wisdom that high taxes and large social safety nets undermine competitiveness. In fact, it's the other way around. They go on to say, and I'm quoting from the study, there is no evidence that this is high taxes and a large social safety net, that these are adversely affecting the ability of these countries to compete effectively in world markets or to provide some of the highest standards of living in the world. That's from the World Economic Forum chief economist Augusto Lopez Claro. In fact, according to the United Nations Human Development Report for 2005, guess what country has the highest standard of living in the world? Norway. Why? It's a welfare state.
What?
Yes. The report, there's a pleasant economic equality enjoyed by the Norwegian polity. No one is too poor, no one is too rich. In fact, great wealth is regarded as some sort of social disease. This, by the way, is true of most indigenous folks all over the world. Tribal people, they look at people who are, you know, just trying to acquire. They view them as mentally ill. Oh, that guy, he's got obsessive compulsive disorder. And sure enough. I mean, the question, in fact, that this article asks is, if it's freedom and success they hate, why aren't they attacking Norway, the freest and most successful country in the world? Good question. 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started in here. Let's
yeah, how about democracy in America? One of the folks in our chat room points out Norway has a lot of oil. Maybe that has something to do with a nice standard of living there. Yeah, it does. And as a matter of fact, in Norway, Norway is tucking away a national fund of over $180 billion for when the oil runs out, guaranteeing each family the quaint sum of $22,000 a year, in addition to enough to guarantee health care, education, pensions, and paid maternity leave and vacations to die for. As Lucinda Bone comments in the op-ed piece she wrote, if it's freedom and success they hate, why aren't they attacking Norway? True, a glass of beer will cost you $8, but the waiter makes a good salary. Odds are you will, too. She says Americans like to think the terrorists attack them because they're rich, free, and number one. Not true. They don't attack Norway. Another benefit of keeping your neck out of the woods, minding your own business, taking care of your own people, and planning for tomorrow. It's just right there. Lays it right out. Very straightforward. Very straightforward. And then, you know, we've got in the United States, not only do we have the economic cons, the cons you go, well, you know, poor people, it's just, we need the poor you will have with you always. Don't you know that's Christianity? Yeah. And so-called Christians. And poverty is just it's a moral disease, and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But by the way, we're not going to give them any bootstraps. In fact, maybe they shouldn't even be here, right? I mean, this our Twilight Zone episode, as it were. I mean, this is just incredible. Yes, Bill Bennett. Bill Bennett, the former drug czar, the former Secretary of Education in the Reagan administration. Now, nationally syndicated talk show host on the Salem Radio Network, John Conyers, today, writing about Bennett's comments yesterday. He says, he thinks that abortion is morally reprehensible. Abortion, morally reprehensible. And, you know, wide-scale abortion, impossible, ridiculous. You wouldn't want to do that. But if you did, there's a way to do it.
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country, and your crime rate would go down. That
what?
Would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do, but your crime rate would go down.
He says it twice. Twice? He repeats himself? Oh. See, now you're seeing. This is the Southern strategy. This is Richard Nixon's Southern strategy writ large. Bill Moyers talks. I interviewed Bill Moyers for this program back about 6 or 8 months ago. He and I sat together in Washington, D.C. And he told me the story of how when he was working in Lyndon Johnson's White House and the Voting Rights Act, the voting rights legislation was before them. They had to pass this thing. And one of their aides came in, I forget which one it was, and said to Lyndon Johnson, in the presence of Bill Moyers, said, if we pass this legislation forcing these southern states to allow African Americans to vote, the Democratic Party will lose the South for a generation, for at least 20 years. And Lyndon Johnson said that's a price that's worth paying to do the right thing. And Richard Nixon perked up his ears and said, hey, you got a bunch of disenfranchised white racists down there. We're going to pick them up. And he called it his Southern strategy. the Southern strategy. Go for the white racist vote. And this has been the official doctrine of the Republican Party ever since. I mean, you have blacks being disenfranchised in Florida, 100,000 African-Americans being taken off the voter rolls before the 2000 election so that they could steal the election. The same thing happened in Ohio, some 70,000 African-Americans taken off the voting rolls before the 2004 election. This is the Southern strategy. What Bill Bennett is saying is simply the mindset. I mean, he's simply representing the worldview of the Republican Party. This is not rocket science. It's not something new. It's not something radical. It's not something unknown. This is Bill Bennett. You know, Bill Bennett simply reflecting that. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. And this hour is yours, Bernie. Hey, Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Thomas.
We have about a minute before we have to take a break. Just I'll give you that minute, and you can say hi and what's on your mind, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll start getting into topics and taking calls.
Well, it's another somber day in the state of Vermont. The reason that I'm late for being on the show is that I just came from another funeral for a very fine young man, 27 year older, who died in Iraq. So I'm here in Rutland, and this is the 19th young man that the state of Vermont has lost. So it's not a good day for Vermont.
19 casualties from the state of Vermont. Has Vermont had that many murders in the same period of time?
No, I doubt that very much.
Yeah, this all across the country. I mean, we're seeing the same thing here in Oregon. Governor Kulongoski, when the war first started, committed that he would go to every funeral. He's been to 54 funerals now. I was talking with him on the radio the other day, and he said it's starting to make him crazy.
Vermont is a small state. So, in fact, in terms of per capita loss, I think we are very close to the top, if not at the top. But it was just a very sad, very large turnout at the Christ the King Church in Rutland. And he was also a police officer, so a lot of his comrades in the law enforcement agencies were there as well. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that happened. I honor you for showing up. And after this break, we'll come back and we'll talk about some of the issues of the day beyond the war in Iraq, or perhaps in addition to the war in Iraq. Congressman Bernie Sanders will be with us. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to call for Congressman Sanders, 1-866-889-8894. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We gave millions to make you president. Here's the chance to pay us back. The inheritance tax makes my fortune feel all funny.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. And Bernie, I noticed that the Republicans are apparently paying attention to your run for the Senate from Vermont. The push polls have already begun, where they call up people and lie to them about you and then say, you know, it's the old have you stopped beating your wife kind of thing. I think they're asking people, do you think Vermont should be represented by a gadfly like Bernie Sanders or by a real politician or something to that effect, as if you're just a gadfly. I mean, you're one of the most effective members of Congress.
Well, this is just the beginning. I mean, the Republican Party is bankrupt in terms of dealing with the real problems facing the middle class and working families, dealing with health care, dealing with the environment. They want to privatize Social Security under Bush's watch. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. Poverty is increasing. They got us into a war in Iraq that we should not have gotten into. They have nothing to say about the real issues affecting people. So what are they going to do?
So they call you names.
That's going to go on for a year, and it'll get a lot worse. But, you know, we anticipate that, and we're ready for that. And we're going to talk real issues to ordinary people about how we can improve the standard of living of the people in Vermont and America, and how we can create an economy that works for everybody rather than just the super rich. But this is, trust me, just the beginning. We're ready for it.
Yeah, and in the context of doing good in government and the forces that are arrayed on the side of corporate interests and suppressing the interests of working people. Tom DeLay was one of the champions of slash and burn politics when it came to anything that would have defended working people in America.
Right.
He's no longer the House Majority Leader. Ray Blunt is now. How's that going to play out?
Roy Blunt. from Missouri.
Roy Blank, thank you.
Well, let me just say a few words about delay, you know, knowing delay slightly. I don't know him terribly well, but your point is well taken. On issue after issue, delay has been at the cutting edge of representing corporate interests, the big money interests, those interests that make large campaign contributions against the needs of working people. And it's interesting right away to point out that while Denny Hastert of Illinois is the Speaker of the House, number one guy, the real power behind the throne, as most people know, is in fact Tom DeLay. The reason that Hastert is the Speaker and the face to the general public is that Hastert comes across as a nice, mild-mannered guy, which he is. But the guy who really calls the tune there, that really keeps the discipline, who is what they call the enforcer, is DeLay. He is really the strength and the iron will of the Republican Party. And it's important to note that DeLay's style, it's not just slash and burn. His goal is to win at any cost. It's not sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. It is you win. And if you're not going to win, you change the rules of the game. We've seen that time and time again. I'll give you some examples. Some of the listeners may remember that there were some charges about DeLay's behavior brought before the Ethics Committee. What DeLay then proceeded to do is change the rules of the Ethics Committee and then get rid of a conservative Republican, Joel Heffley, from Colorado, who was the chairman. So he didn't like what was going on. Instead of defending himself, you change the rules and you get rid of the chairman.
That's called cheating in the real world, isn't it?
That's right, but it goes on and on, and that's their style. I'll give you another example. Perhaps the major bill, very controversial bill, to my mind, a terrible bill, this prescription drug Medicare bill, which was written by the pharmaceutical industry, for the pharmaceutical industry, going to cost taxpayers a huge sum of money and give very little benefit to seniors who need it. We get 17 minutes to vote, Tom, in the House. You got a card, you put in. At the end of 17 minutes, DeLay's proposition, Bush's proposition, had lost. So what they proceeded to do is keep the rolls open from 3 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the morning until they twisted some exhausted Republican arms, allegations of bribery on the floor of the House, so that they finally won that vote. That's like at the end of a four-quarter football game. Your team is behind, no problem. You play a fifth quarter, a sixth quarter, a seventh quarter until you get the votes. Now, to me personally, over a year ago, I introduced a bill in opposition to a section of the USA Patriot Act. At the end of the 17 minutes, my amendment had won by, I think, 10 votes. DeLay didn't like it. He kept the voting rolls open another 20 minutes, turned around some Republicans. We lost that vote by a 210-210 tie. We eventually won it the following year. The other thing that DeLay does that people should know, when you're the muscle in the Republican Party, if you don't want a piece of legislation to come to the floor of the House, you just keep it away, even if you know that the votes are there to pass it. For example, a couple of years ago, we passed what's called prescription drug reimportation, which means that American pharmacists and prescription drug distributors and ordinary people should be able to buy FDA-approved medicine from Canada, from Europe, where the same exact product is sold at a fraction of the price. We passed it. Almost every Democrat voted for it. Many Republicans voted for it. We had the votes. We have the votes today. You know what? Despite a letter that went to Hastert and DeLay saying, with a majority of the members of the House saying, we want to vote on a bill. We can't get a vote on that bill.
Because they schedule the votes.
They schedule the votes, and many people don't know that. Oh, why don't you bring this thing up? You can't get anything onto the floor of the House unless Tom DeLay says you can get it onto the floor, with a few exceptions. In some bills, there are open rules, and you can. But by and large, you can do that. Now, it's interesting. DeLay has been indicted. He's now within the judicial system. But here is a guy who has spent a lot of energy trying in many ways to destroy the independent judiciary in America. The courts in Florida, for example, have dealt with the Terry Schiavo case time and time and time again. DeLay said, well, forget Florida. We're going to bring it right here to the floor of the House. We're going to override them. He has threatened, in some instances, judges because he didn't like the decisions that they made. You have a situation now in Washington where there is virtually no oversight. I'm on the Government Reform Committee, whose job it is to take a look at what happens in all aspects of government. What I can tell you is when Clinton was president, that committee was meeting overtime. If they thought that Clinton spent too much money on Christmas cards, they had hearings on it. Here you have huge debate, huge controversy over the war in Iraq, the fact that Bush misled the American people, the fact that Bush and Cheney were putting tremendous pressure on the intelligence agency to give them the information that they wanted so they can go to war in Iraq. We have not had one hearing on that issue. You have a situation where, in terms of this very same Medicare prescription drug bill, the guy who was the Medicare actuary was asked by members of Congress to tell us, in your judgment, how much this bill was cost. He couldn't because he was threatened with being fired by Bush officials. No discussion, no hearings on that. And all of the scandals that have taken place within the Bush administration, the improprieties, the poor management, virtually no hearings. So what you have now, you know, I think it was Lord Acton who said that was power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
You have a president and administration of extreme right-wingers. You have a House of Representatives, DeLay and his friends, extreme right-wingers. A Senate, Bill Frist and his friends, extreme right-wingers. And these guys have become increasingly arrogant, increasingly disrespectful of law. And that's where we are today. But I have the feeling that the American people are beginning to catch on. I think we're seeing some of that ramifications now.
Yeah, although it's fascinating. We have to take a break in about a half a minute, and then we'll go to our phone calls. But it's fascinating that all the news media, CBS didn't even mention last night when they reported on DeLay saying that Ronnie Earl was a partisan, that Ronnie Earl's prosecuted more Democrats than Republicans. Everybody's repeating Tom DeLay's spin.
Yeah, well.
In the mainstream media, it's just, I mean, they're just taking Tom
DeLay's
spin and
running with it. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Okay, all right. We'll come back to that. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. Bernie's with us every Friday, our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be right back. Actually, we are right back. Hey, Bernie. I don't know what's going on here. I've got... Our automation system seems to have croaked. It's showing me that it's playing a stinger, but I've got nothing coming out. So we'll see what happens. We might be interrupted by a commercial here. But you said you were going to make a point. Go for it.
Well, the main point to be made is that you have a one-party arrogance now, which day after day, issue after issue, is beholden to big money interests and corporate interests. The bottom line, I mean, what DeLay's philosophy is that if you want legislation to get onto the floor of the House, you're going to have to make campaign contributions. So when you see that prescription drug bill, that was written by the pharmaceutical industry, check how much money the pharmaceutical industry has given to the Republican Party and George Bush. We talk about the bankruptcy bill. Well, that was written by the banks and the credit card companies. People are going to be a day late, or they're going to be late in paying their credit cards because of the high gas prices or the squeeze on the middle class. Some of those people are going to be paying 20, 25, 28% interest rates, and any effort to try to lower those interest rates is virtually impossible because of the power and the campaign contributions of the credit card companies. The energy bill, here we are paying over with $3 a gallon, $2.80 a gallon, at a time when ExxonMobil and these other huge oil companies are enjoying record-breaking profits. Well, guess what happened in the last energy bill? The big oil companies, the last people in the world, who should be receiving corporate welfare, taxpayer support, because they're hugely profitable. Well, they're getting billions of dollars in profit.
And on it goes. Bernie, my machine tells me in 2 seconds we're off. Let's see if we go. There we go. We'll be back. Thank you, Bernie, for putting up with that. I don't know what's going on here with this. Every now and then, technology just gets weird on you, you know, and I guess today was our day for it to get really weird. It's Tom Hartman with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls and more here on the Tom Hartman radio program. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm George W. Don't you cry for me. Now I've made it to the White House. That's in Washington, D.C.
That's D.C., W. And welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes before the hour, 9.5, or 50 minutes after the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-888-9889. Forward with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Ask you to keep your comments really short because we got a lot of calls in very few minutes. Armin in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Armin, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, Congressman Sanders, I can't tell you first off, I've never said this before, but you're the kind of person that people that believe in God believe put here on this earth to help us, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate you and how much we think you are a superhuman being.
Well, I am not, but I thank you very much. I thought I'm a superhuman being, but I thank you for your sentiments, Armin.
Okay, and Tom, if we had real representatives that really cared about this country and the working people, like Bernie says, and not just the wealthy, isn't it Chavez that we're having the problems with? Was it is in Venezuela?
Yes.
Wouldn't it be a wise thing to do if these proponents of trade really believe, you know, what they're trying to sell us, which we know has been kind of the distortion of reality so far? But why wouldn't you say to Chavez, why wouldn't you say to the oil companies, okay, you're not going to get any breaks unless you buy big vehicles that we can't afford to run here in the United States, and you can export them and trade for petroleum instead of going to war against that little country. And then their economy could be boosted down there in Venezuela because he could print more money.
Yeah, it's a good start. Thoughts, Bernie?
Well, I mean, Almond hit it right on the head. The fact of the matter is, instead of giving billions of dollars in tax breaks and subsidies to these oil companies, we should be using our leverage to, A, move this country toward energy conservation, sustainable energy, lower the price of oil. I have the feeling that in a few days when ExxonMobil comes out with their quarterly earnings, they're going to be off the wall.
Steve, a trucker in North Carolina. Please keep it short, Steve. What's up?
Hey, how you doing, guys? You know, we could reach some consensus here. I mean, I think Republicans are running in a little bit ramrod here, but we can reach some consensus here. Like, for example, the energy bill. You give us Anwar, I'll give you cafe standards on SUVs, stuff like that. Like, you give us refineries, I'll make one of them a biodiesel.
Okay, what do you think, Bernie?
I think that, no, I'm very strongly opposed to drilling in Anwar. I think the technology is now there. I know, Tom, you talk about this all the time, but your cars that get 70, 80 miles per gallon. We can harness solar energy. We can harness wind energy. We can have an energy revolution right now, and that's where we should be investing as Americans.
Bill in Long Island, New York. Hey, Bill.
Yes, gentlemen. Two quick things. One, I'd like to know what his feeling is on the use of the mercenaries rather than the National Guard down south. And two,
you mean the Blackwater folks in New Orleans?
Exactly. And the other quick thing is that why is no one making a big deal that Bush left those parishes of Orleans and so forth out of his decree when Governor Blanco had included them in hers?
Bernie?
I think it's a very bad idea, a very dangerous idea, a very ominous idea that we use mercenaries rather than people in the United States military or the National Guard. In terms of what the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast, my major concern right now is that Bush and his friends don't use this disaster just to push their right-wing ideology in doing away with prevailing wage, giving no-bid contracts to groups like Carnival and Halliburton, rather than rebuilding that community with workers who are going to earn decent wages and in a way that works for the needs of the people in that area.
Brian in Phoenix, Arizona, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Bernie. I'm tired of the lies and the hypocrisy and the corruption of both parties in this country, and they're really hurting the American people. I think that we need to definitely get corporate money out of politics. We need to have campaign reform. Can we count on Bernie to help us out with that?
Absolutely. I think the key issue is the amount of money that comes into the political process. It is just incredible, and it's money that buys power. What we do need to do is move toward public funding of elections. We have some states, Maine, Arizona, Vermont to some degree, and there's going to be a big Supreme Court case over some language in Vermont's campaign finance bill. But absolutely, we need to control spending. We need to make it public funding. We need to stop big money from buying the United States government through the political process.
Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Congressman Sanders. Oh, we just lost Jim. Peter in Eureka, California. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Oh, yeah, Bernie and Tom, I just want to ask, why are conservatives or Republicans so hate social safety net so much or have such antipathy or suspicion of him? Just both your comments or one comment.
Well, some of these guys, and it's not all of them, some of them, I think, want to go back to the 1920s when big money and corporations had all of the power. If you destroy Social Security and you give retirement commissions to Wall Street, A, a lot of people are going to make a lot of money, and B, you do away with the safety net that millions of people enjoy and just give more power to big money over the lives of ordinary people rather than guaranteeing people certain rights as citizens of this country.
In other words, every time we eliminate a government program, we create a power vacuum or a vacuum, a need vacuum that can be filled by somebody who can make money off it and control our lives that
way.
Right.
And you're hearing many of these guys say, you know, you don't need Medicare, we don't need Medicaid, you don't need Social Security. You know, we'll go back to charity. And if wealthy people want to make a contribution to somebody, that's fine. And the whole struggle of the last century is rights of people, rights of working people, that when you're old, you will get Medicare. You will have Social Security. When you're poor, you will have Medicaid. You will have food stamps. And on issue after issue, these guys are moving to destroy that entire social safety net.
Yeah, it's as Rush Limbaugh said, and he was not undersaying it.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Right, and the result of all of that is that we now have the wealthiest 1% seeing an explosion in their income and wealth while the middle class shrinks and poverty is increasing in America.
Yeah, and it's becoming a crisis, increasingly, a terrible crisis. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.org or bernie.house.gov. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, every Friday here with us. Bernie, so great having you with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you again, and thanks. We'll see you next week. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. For a change.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Live 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time on radio stations all across the country. So glad to have you with us. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jack in Port Townsend, Washington on the line. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Yeah, been listening to your concerns over the past few days about alternate energy and necessity to make a transition from petroleum-based in particular. And I kind of wanted to put that in a little bit of perspective by indicating the problems of depending on the free market to set prices effectively. And the main problem, of course, is that the petroleum industry, for example, is a stock resource, and the depletion costs are not reflected.
Right. The bottom line is that what you have is a lot of corporations who are looking at how can we maximize profits short term, how can we internalize profits, and how can we externalize costs. And one of the main costs of extracting oil is that there ain't going to be no more of it down the road, and something else is going to have to fill that void, or that you could identify that as one of the main costs. And that's not something that's being considered, at least in the United States. That is being considered in a lot of European countries. It's one of the reasons why it costs $5 a gallon for gasoline. It's probably up to $7 or $8 a gallon now, but because they have these high taxes in order to discourage consumption, because they know that down the road they're going to have to make those conversions, and they are in many countries.
I would like to see, just wondering what you thought about using a surtax and probably a tariff on imports to raise the cost of petroleum-based materials and to create a fund that would be used to develop alternative energy.
I think it's an ideal idea, and it was a suggestion. It was part of Jimmy Carter's policies way back when. It just makes common sense to me. Thanks for the call. Jerry in Michigan. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, not much. I was wondering if you could answer me why so many on the left are so offended by the recitation of certain facts. I'll give you three quick examples. The president of Harvard, this is something that's roundly recognized in all the academic journals of biologists, said that women's brains don't work in the cognitive sphere as well as men's brains. I mentioned in a women's studies class that women are weaker than men. And Bill Bennett said that if you aborted all of the black babies, that crime would go down. He wasn't for this, of course, and he said right afterwards, this is despicable. But just the recitation of these facts causes all kinds of conundrums to be thrown.
You really think? I'm sorry, Jerry. I'm not. That is, you really think if you abort black babies, you're going to reduce crime? Carl in Bristol, Connecticut. Hey, Carl. I'm not even going to dignify it with a response. Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Long-time listener, first-time caller. And I just want to cut right to the chase. I just got done listening to the bunch with Bernie, and I want to know what is a good proactive first step to make sure that we can start building more Bernies? Because the fact of the matter is, in the 21st, we have an America where we have one party trying to build an America for the 90s and another party trying to build an America for the 19th century. That's no good for me, and that's no good for the future kids I want to have, Tom.
There you go.
How can we build more Bernies?
Well, it's very, very simple, very straightforward process, and that is that we get more people involved. I mean, what Bernie has done in Vermont is, I mean, you know, he was the mayor of Burlington. He was the mayor of a small town. He stepped out and got involved himself and ran for Congress. But he did so. He was able to do so because a lot of people showed up. And the reason a lot of people showed up was because he has great ideas. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. And Bernie would come into town and he'd have a pot like that. In fact, I showed up at one of Bernie's fundraisers. You know what the price of admission was?
How much?
Free. It was a potluck. People brought their own food free. And the suggested donation, the amount that they were asking people, that, you know, if they would give, if they came to this thing, was $10 to $25.
Now, I'm sure a lot of people gave, too.
Oh, yeah. But the point is, it was free, and you could come, and you could sit, and you could talk with Bernie. And Bernie does, you know, probably 100 a year. I mean, he's constantly doing these things, several times a week, doing these town halls all around the state of Vermont. Peter DeFazio here in Oregon, another congressman who is that kind of congressman, very progressive, very involved, and very in touch with his grassroots, you know, with his grassroots supporters. There are probably a dozen, maybe not even that, members of Congress like that. And frankly, I don't know of any senators like that. And, you know, Paul Wellstone was the last one. And Bernie is running for the United States Senate. He might become the first senator like that. Yeah. But I mean, the bottom line is to build more Bernies, Carl, we all need to get involved. And that's, you know, there's just no other way to say it than that we need to get involved. We've been spending enough time sitting back saying, well, gee, wouldn't it be nice? But we have to get involved. Robert Garmong is with us. He's a specialist in political theory, ethics, and philosophy at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And I bring Robert and some of the other folks from Ayn Rand on this program regularly because Ayn Rand, her book Atlas Shrugged, and some of her other books, really is one of the foundational thinkers of what has become known as objectivist thought, which then kind of was a stepping off point for a lot of folks that call themselves libertarians, which has become a stepping off point for a lot of folks who call themselves conservatives, although I'm sure that Robert would not identify himself as either a libertarian or a conservative. Am I right, Robert?
That's right.
Okay. You're an objectivist?
Well, they don't necessarily want to be identified with me.
Okay. Nor would they want to be identified with you. But your worldview, I think, informs all of them. And this issue of, you know, intelligent design in our schools, should we be teaching evolution and intelligent design are on equal footing, that maybe the world was created 5,000 years ago, maybe it was created 5 billion years ago, or the universe. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that this sort of thing is absolutely not, does not belong in the public schools, and I think that it is a violation of religious freedom to teach any such thing because it would constitute establishment of religion.
In violation of the First Amendment.
That's right. But I think there's an interesting conundrum here because people on the right have, of the religious variety, for once I actually agree with them on something, they make the point very validly that not to teach religion and instead to teach nothing but secular ideas is a violation of their religious freedom, because their ideas, their money is taken to support ideas that they abhor, which, as Thomas Jefferson said, is a violation of their rights. So I think that all of these debates that we have of intelligent design, the Pledge of Allegiance, which was just debated in Congress yesterday, and they've encouraged the Supreme Court to take up the question of whether the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional, and I think it is, as long as it has one nation under God in it. That, too, is establishment of religion.
It could just as easily say under gods.
Exactly, or as it originally did, one nation indivisible.
Right.
With no reference to God at all until...
1956, I think it was. Yeah.
That's right.
So really the bottom line here of your suggestion is not so much, though, you know, that we agree that religion shouldn't be part of our schools, but rather you're suggesting we shouldn't even have public schools.
Yes, I think that really all ideas are interconnected, and really anything you teach that has any controversy whatsoever connected to it has some sort of religious implications, and there you can find someone somewhere whose religious ideas are opposed to it. Any sort of scientific fact, any ideas about evolution whatsoever.
So you're saying any of this stuff would contradict religion, and that might be the establishment of an anti-religion or of an opposite religion. But it really isn't that kind of a red herring, Robert Garmung. I mean, really isn't the bottom line that as an objectivist, you really think that the whole idea of the state supporting education is wrong, that education should simply be available to those people who can afford to pay for it?
Well, I think that these are not unconnected facts. I do ultimately think that education, like any other good, should be provided on the basis of the free market, and I think that the disastrous public schools are not a coincidence. But I think that this.
But the public schools brought us the middle class. I mean, you have people who came to this country literally illiterate, and a generation later, their children are doctors and lawyers, and because of public education. What's wrong with that?
Before we had public education, we did have private schools that were charitable and that did educate the young of all classes and all racial and ethnic groups. And I think they did a better job.
And you had huge swaths of America that were illiterate. And that had no way of breaking out of their social class.
Tom, I think that the real thing that gave rise to the middle class in America is capitalism, ultimately.
Robert, let's continue this discussion after this break, because I acknowledge the value of capitalism. Frankly, I think that free enterprise has higher value than capitalism. But nonetheless, we'll get into those details right after this break. We're talking with Robert Garmung and the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND. If you want to jump into the conversation as well, give us a call, 866-889-8894. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle dazzle. You razzle dazzled them.
Oh, you did so good, George.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it, made them believe you were compassionate.
Or actually, it was Carl Rove, wasn't it?
The old hope. Hocus, you misdirected him with 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. And
who knows what evil lurks in the heart?
find out. We're speaking with Robert Garmong of the Ayn Rand Institute, ayanrand.org. Hey, Robert.
Good to be here, Tom.
What possible rationale can you have for saying that we should have no public schools, that it should be entirely private, that if some private school decides that they want to let some poor person in, well, that's fine, but, I mean, you're contradicting Thomas Jefferson. He started the University of Virginia as a free public school to increase social mobility so that we could have a meritocracy, which I would think is something that you would like, rather than an aristocracy where wealth is passed from generation to generation and they lock everybody else out.
Well, certainly I have great admiration for Thomas Jefferson. I agree that education is a good thing. I'm an educator myself. But I think that, like all good, education should be provided and is better provided by the free market than by governmental schools.
How?
Well, I think that we see today who is failing in our country today. Is it the graduates of parochial schools? No, it's the graduates of these abysmal public schools.
But does that have anything to do with public or private schools? I mean, I have worked in both, frankly, and I'm the chairman of the board of directors of a private school, have been for 17 years. And I can tell you, it's not, is it private or is it public? It's what kind of family were you raised in? How much money do you have?
I agree with that. I think that is a fundamental
factor. It's not even what race you are, as much as Bill Bennett would like to think it is.
Absolutely not. I've taught at a predominantly black college, and I had some terrific students, and I've had some abysmal failures at Lily White universities. So there's no racial aspect to it.
Right. So why not say, Robert, that there is this thing called the commons? This is what I don't get. Why conservatives, libertarians, objectivists are so opposed to the idea of a commons, so opposed to the idea that there are things that we collectively do for us because ultimately it benefits all of us. It benefits all of us for there to be social mobility. It benefits all of us for there to be a strong middle class, even if it means that men with guns are going to show up to enforce tax laws and take our hard-earned dollars away. Still, it benefits all of us ultimately to have a public education system. Why would you be opposed to that?
Well, my view is that it's precisely those men with guns that lie behind it, and I think that's.
But they're going to. Finish. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
I appreciate your side, but my view is that the initiation of force is always and everywhere a bad thing, and that it doesn't matter if your goal is noble, if you accomplish it by means of theft, that invalidates it as a violation of individual rights.
But two points. The first is those men with guns, also known as tax collectors, are going to show up asking for taxes for a military, which you support, do you not?
That's right.
Okay, so you're not entirely opposed to taxes. You're not entirely opposed to the idea of a commons. You think that the military as a commons is a good idea, right?
Well, ultimately, I do think that, you know, in a truly free society, there would be other means of funding the government than taxation. But under the current conditions, obviously that's something you couldn't stop taxes tomorrow. If I could wave a magic wand, that would not be what I would wave it at.
Right. Okay. So number one. And number two, then, if we're all agreeing that we are going to allow men with guns to show up at our houses and take our tax dollars to pay for the military, then we are agreeing that there is a social contract between us all. Are we not?
Well, social contract is a very vague term, and it's used in all sorts of contradictory ways.
We're agreeing. Let's take that word out of it. We're agreeing that we can all agree that there are some things that we all agree, or the majority of us agree, even if the minority doesn't like it, that as long as we're not trampling on the rights of the minority, and we're not defining those minorities by things like race, that there are some things that are to the benefit of all of us, like public education or like having a military, and we're all going to agree to pay into that. That's part of, you know, and when you're born into a society, you have a choice. You can leave the country, you can pay your taxes.
My view is that it's not an issue of our collective agreement that we need a military. It's an issue of the initiation of force and protection from that. And that's the one thing that I think allows for the existence of a government and requires the existence of a government.
Yeah. Okay. Robert, got a couple callers who want to kick this around with you. Can you stick around for just a minute?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. 27 minutes past the hour. the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Brought to you today, by the way, by EcoWine, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Give them a call. Say hi. 27 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And the Reverend Pat Robertson denounced the ERA. He said, feminists don't really want equal rights and equal pay. They want women to leave their homes, murder all their children. And lesbians. Family values.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past, 34, 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, family values. We're talking with Robert Garmong of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And Robert, the bottom line here is that one of the fundamental concepts of democracy in a republic, in a constitutionally limited republic, is that if the majority of the people agree on extending the commons, on saying, for example, rather than, you know, you and I have agreed that the military is part of the commons. Let's extend that to the police. Let's extend that to the fire department. We're going to pay for those things. Let's extend that to roads. We're going to pay for those things. If we agree to extend it to public education, that becomes the law of the land. That's democracy. Ultimately, you really don't believe in democracy, do you?
That's right. I believe in individual rights, the protection of which includes the existence of a government, a police department, a military, and very limited institutions.
But not in a democratic system. You do not believe in democracy. And so individual rights in that context, I mean, aren't you talking anarchy?
No, absolutely not. I do believe in the existence of a government, and I believe, let's be clear, when I say I'm against democracy, I mean I'm against the idea that we can get together and vote away someone's individual rights. I'm not against the idea of voting, of course, but I do believe
by individual right, you're talking about the right to not pay taxes. I mean, let's just be really clear. Let's not use euphemisms here. You're not talking about that we can get together and vote away the right of a person to, for example, show up at a restaurant and be served.
I believe in the rights to life, liberty, property, pursuit of happiness, and that includes the right not to pay taxes. It includes the right to walk into a restaurant if you want to, and I'm against Jim Crow laws as much as I'm against any other kind of invasion of individual rights.
So did I hear you correctly say the right not to pay taxes?
I agreed with you saying, yes, there is a right not to pay taxes. Now, that in today's society, that right is standardly abridged, and I don't advocate not paying taxes. It's unwise, but I do think you have a right not to. I believe in the absolute right to property.
So when Thomas Jefferson took John Locke's life, liberty, and private property and changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, you think he made a mistake? He should have left it life, liberty, and private property.
I do believe in the right to private property. I think there were particular reasons having to do with the British system, in which property included the supposed ownership of peasants and so on. And I think there were very specific technical reasons that people shied away from using the term right to property. But I do believe that it should have been included, yes.
So the right to property then trumps human rights, for example. You think that, I'm just trying to understand this. If somebody is trying to take your property by force as opposed to trying to take your life by force, should you have the right to take their life?
I think in general, no. I think in general I can't imagine, it depends on the particular situation, but no, I don't believe in using lethal force to protect one's property.
Okay.
That's why we have a government.
Right. Okay. It's interesting, but you know, I'm just confounded by this concept of the commons not extending to beyond, you know, that Ayn Rand came up with this notion that the commons is arbitrarily the military and perhaps police functions. But, you know, why, that's just the fundamental difference in our worldviews. Let's take a few quick calls here, and we got to move along. Suzanne in Olympia, Washington. Suzanne, you're live with Robert Garmong.
Hi. Thanks for doing the show. I just had one comment and then a question. I find your guests' comments about public education really offensive, about public education producing failures and private schools not. If you look at my family alone, public school has produced 2 Harvard graduates, one who has graduated from Harvard Law School, one who is now currently in Harvard Law School, MIT graduate, BU graduate, Columbia graduate, all public school children, Stanford graduate. So, you know, he can take that thought and then think about the President of the United States, who's had a private education paid for by his daddy, and he's a failure, and his grades were a failure. So that's just BS. Now, my question is, has this man ever been in a country where they don't have public education? And I would like to follow up with that.
Okay. Robert, have you?
Well, yes, I have, as a matter of fact. But let me.
And what country was that?
I've been to several different places. I've been in not necessarily the country of Mexico, but in the particular area where I was, there were no such thing as public schools.
No public schools. And did the libertarian experiment there work out really well?
Well, it was not a libertarian experiment. This is Mexico, after all, which is not a free market and by any stretch of the imagination. If I could respond to the comment, I do not mean to say that everyone who goes through public schooling is a failure. I myself am a product of public schooling, so I would be indicting myself in that way. That's an illicit conversion. What I said was that the public school system as a whole is a failure, and I think no one would disagree with that.
I would disagree with that.
I would as well. The public school system has succeeded in tremendous ways. I mean, it's one of the great successes of this century of changing the idea of the Spinnenschulen, which is really where it began back in Germany in the late 1700s, where, you know, yes, send your child to work in our mill, and half days will give them an education in exchange for that. That's, you know, the beginning of this whole thing. And then Fichte's idea of education in 1809, after Napoleon beat the Prussians at the Battle of Jena, Fichte came up with the idea of how do you create an educated army. You know, from those weird seeds of public education, we now have a system that actually ensures middle classes in those countries where it's widespread.
And it's overall a good system. Then you take a neat private school like St. Paul's School, where, you know, the head of the school absconds with hundreds of thousands of dollars for himself. That's what you're looking at when you look at private education.
Well,
CEOs.
In defense of both, let me say, not always, Suzanne. But I get your point. Thank you very much. I want to move along here. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, guys. Real quick. First of all, Ayn Rand, you know, you could almost substitute Marie Antoinette for that name, you know, so you might want to call it the Marie Antoinette.
Well, but the fact of the matter is that what Robert is saying is not that different from what Grover Norquist is saying. It's not that different from what George W. Bush is saying. Right now, right, exactly. What Bush is doing right now is he's trying to put a huge voucher bill into the Katrina relief bill so that people can use vouchers with religious schools to get their education while the New Orleans school districts are down, rather than giving money to public schools to help them deal with the overload. This is and it's going to be the largest public school voucher program in the history of the United States. They're trying to sneak this stuff in.
What they're going to do is end up creating a permanent underclass. What they fail to realize is that the private schools, the reason their numbers are so skewed as far as their supposed success rate is because they take the cream of the crop. They get the people that have the money first of all to do it. Now they're going to extend that, but the private schools will be discriminating in who they allow in, and they do kick people out of schools and stuff. And public schools try to educate the masses, and the people that start off slowly or whatever, they're taking in also in the public schools. And what's going to end up happening is no public schools, and then there's going to be a certain group of us that don't get educated at all, and you're going to have a larger permanent underclass than what you saw in New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and that's
absolutely,
what we're aiming for. And that's, you know, he said Mexico. Mexico's ruled by, what, 36 families.
Yeah, it's an oligarchy.
And that's what their ideal is. That's what I'm afraid their actual ideal is. And that's what I'm afraid that they're trying to aim this country towards.
Well, there's the point, Dennis, then. Thank you for making it. Robert, how do you avoid your idea turning into oligarchy? I mean, if you have no inheritance taxes, if there's no limit on the amount of wealth somebody can accumulate, if you have no way for people to move from one social class to another because they don't have the money to be able to afford to go to the private schools that you're suggesting, how do you prevent there being a permanent underclass? Or is that what you'd like? Because then you have lots of cheap labor for the factories that are owned by the people who have the rights and the property.
No, Tom, that's just not what I'm after. But I think you have to say, under my system, it would not be such an issue as oligarchy, because oligarchy is a rule by the small group of families and so on. But no one would have any power over anyone else other than the right to demand not to be coerced. So,
can you give me one example, Robert, of this ever happening in the history of the world successfully?
The closest that we've ever come to someone actually having a capitalistic society, as I advocate, is the United States of America, and particularly in our earlier days, and I think it is one of the great success stories in history.
We had public education in the 1780s. We had public police departments. We had, we had poorhouses that were paid for with tax dollars. In fact, it was such a common thing that with James Madison in 1812 vetoed a bill to start having the churches be the beneficiaries of that. He said he didn't want to mix religion and secularism, so it had to go to a secular institution. They were government owned. I mean, we've never had a pure capitalist system in this country like you're describing.
I agree. I said the closest we've ever come.
The answer to my question is no. There has never been an example of a libertarian or an objectivist society. A pure capitalist society that has been successful.
Yes.
I would say that there have been pure capitalist societies. It was called feudalism. And it was where the lords owned the land, they owned the people on the land, which is essentially the same thing, and that, you know, it ruled for thousands of years. It's a very stable system that you're encouraging, but it's not, you know, it doesn't allow for a middle class.
Feudalism is the opposite of capitalism. It's a top-down society in which the government owns, it's not the
No, the government owns nothing. In fact, that was what the Magna Carta was all about. It was the feudal lords.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance.
And you might have to serve the wealthy, those with the power.
You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve some.
Yeah, isn't that really what it comes down to, Robert Garmong? That the old joke that the newspaper baron made, that the golden rule is that those with the gold get to make the rules.
That one shouldn't confuse capitalism with a system in which people have the right to initiate force, and feudalism is a system in which the lord can dictate everything about your life. And if you happen not to be the person in power, then you have no rights whatsoever.
But how can you suggest that wealth doesn't equal force ultimately? If somebody has the ability to withhold from you the ability to have the money to buy food, how is that not a form of force?
No one can prevent me from getting the money to buy food. If one employer doesn't like me, I can go to another. If one provider doesn't want to serve me, I can go to another. There's always the opportunity to, as long as we're living under the realm of persuasion rather than force.
But what if the simple fact of the matter is, Robert, though, that that's not the case, that there are many people who don't have the, you know, there are not as many jobs as there are workers out there. And that there are, and many of these jobs pay so little that people have to work two and three jobs to survive. I mean,
I'm one of those people, Tom.
Okay, so in the world that you're advocating, I just don't see how you're going to have a middle class. As far as I can tell, every single middle class in history has come about as a result of government intervention, period.
I disagree with that. I think that the middle class has always been the product of wealth and prosperity, and wealth and prosperity come from private free enterprise, not from government.
Arguably, the most free enterprise period that we had in the United States was not at the founding of this country. It was between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Great Depression, the period from 1870, more or less, until 1929. That was the time when you had the Supreme Court ruling that it was unconstitutional to have child labor laws, the Supreme Court ruling that it was unconstitutional to have minimum wage laws, which I know you would agree with. You're opposed to minimum wage laws. The Supreme Court ruling that the government had no place involving itself in the marketplace unless it was commerce between the states. All of these, constitutional principles that Scalia and Thomas embrace, for example, and presumably Roberts, and what we had was virtually no middle class. You had the only middle class that existed in the United States were basically people on self-sufficient family farms. But by and large, in the cities and in the suburban areas of the United States, you had, during that period of what we refer to as the Gilded Age or the Robber Baron Age, a very, very small middle class. It was mostly just professionals, the occasional doctor or shop owner, and pretty much everybody else was either a poor worker or a rich owner.
Well, Tom, you can look at that history in two different ways. You can look at it and say, from the perspective of today, we had a very small middle class. I can look at it and say, from the perspective of anything that had existed before, we had a huge growing middle class, and that was when we established the foundation of the middle class that we have today. That's when, for instance, in my family, we went from being peasant farmers to being middle class.
But that foundation was in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt coming along and saying, no, with the Wagner Act in 1935, you have the absolute right to unionize, that the economic power of combined capital could be met by the economic power of combined labor, that the minimum wage laws, the public education laws, the public works spending, I mean, all these things that you would oppose, free education for all. In fact, in many states, you could get a free college education. Ronald Reagan put the end to the last of those in California.
Well, and Tom, let me say one thing that we would probably agree on, and that is I'm not going to defend every policy in the supposedly more free times in our country. For instance, there were anti-unionization laws in the 19th century, and I absolutely oppose those every bit as much as I oppose any kind of compulsory unionization. And I oppose any kind of laws that deliberately protect businesses or that provide subsidies for businesses at the taxpayers' expense.
Mm-hmm.
So there were things that absolutely worked against the formation of a middle class, but I would say that was the time when the middle class was created, and of course it's grown over time as prosperity has grown, but my view is that it was capitalism in the 19th century that laid the foundation.
But the size of the middle class has dropped by about 5.5% since Ronald Reagan came into power, when your kind of policies started to become more fashionable, and it grew like crazy from the 1930s until 1980, when we had all this socialist stuff going on, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can chuckle,
but you can look at the statistics. Come on, Robert, you know I'm telling the truth.
Hey, I actually don't know you're telling the truth because I don't have my finger on the statistics. I was once an econ major. I'm not anymore. So
okay, I mean, this isn't like from some weird think tank. It's like, the federal government. You look at inflation-adjusted wages, and they have been in a steady decline ever since 1980 for the middle class. They've been in a through-the-roof increase for the CEO class since the 1980s, whereas they were relatively steady from the period of the 1940s until the period of until around 1980, because you had high marginal tax rates.
Yeah, well, Tom, we can debate tax policy. It's been the most freewheeling discussion. That's why I love this show, Tom. We can go anywhere on this show, but my view is that what you have when you have a free market is the opportunity for people to break through any class barriers, any racial barriers, any kind of...
If they have enough money.
I think you make your own money.
Oh, okay. Okay. Robert, we'll have to leave it at that. I mean, I've I'll give you the, I gave you the last word.
Tom, we'll be back on it again.
There you go. We certainly will. Robert Garmonger, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. It's always interesting to hear the other side without the weasel words of the Grover Norquist's bunch, without getting into the partisan side of it. I really appreciate the conversations. So thank you so much for being with us, Robert, this hour. And those callers who wanted to get on talk with Robert, we'll pick you up in the next hour. We'll come back around to this. Robert's got to move along. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Bernie Sanders took on the only member of the administration who actually was initiated by Ayn Rand in her apartment in New York City in the 1950s or 1960s. I believe it was 1964. I'd have to go back and look. Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan was still is, an objectivist, a believer in the principles of Ayn Rand. You know, one of the folks that Grover Norquist and the cons have taken to the extreme. And before we go to the calls here, I just want to play for you just this little clip of Bernie Sanders talking to Alan Greenspan and Alan Greenspan's response. It's really pretty revealing here, just to share with you.
Mr. Greenspan, I have long been concerned that you are way out of touch with the needs of the middle class and working families of our country, that you see your major function in your position as the need to represent the wealthy and large corporations. And I must tell you that your testimony today only confirms all of my suspicions. And I urge you, and I mean this seriously.
Now, before we continue with this, this is a hearing, Alan Greenspan before Congress. It was from about a year ago. And Greenspan had been talking about, you know, the economy is going fine and we really don't need to have, any support for unemployed people and all that kind of thing, because the free market will answer everything. And Bernie wasn't buying it.
Because you're an honest person. I think you just don't know what's going on in the real world. And I would urge you, come with me to Vermont. Meet real people. The country clubs and the cocktail parties are not real America. The millionaires and billionaires are the exception to the rule.
Alan Greenspan and his wife Andrea Mitchell, of course, both of them multi-millionaires.
You talk about an improving economy while we have lost 3 million private sector jobs in the last 2 years. Long-term unemployment has more than tripled. Unemployment is higher than it has been since 1994. We have a $4 trillion national debt. 1.4 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Millions of seniors can't afford prescription drugs. Middle-class families can't send their kids to college because they don't have the money to do that. Bankruptcy cases have increased by a record-breaking 23%. Business investment is at its lowest level in more than 50 years. CEOs make more than 500 times of what their workers make. The middle class is shrinking. We have the greatest gap between the rich and the poor of any industrialized nation, and this is an economy that is improving. I hate to see what would happen if our economy was sinking. Now, today, you may not have known this. I suspect that you don't, but you have insulted tens of millions of American workers.
It was Greenspan again saying, you know, we don't need to have an increase in the minimum wage, by the way. And wait until you hear Greenspan's response to this. He'll say, everything is fine for a country our size. In other words, a country smaller, that should be different. In other words, everything is fine. It's like saying, if you only talk about If we were to discuss all the cars in the city of New York, except the ones that are yellow, right? That's a bad metaphor. But anyway, you'll hear it when it comes.
Have defended over the years, among other things, the abolition of the minimum wage, one of your policies, and giving huge tax breaks to billionaires. But today you reached a new low, I think, by suggesting that manufacturing in America doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where the product is produced.
This is where Greenspan was saying that we didn't need to change our trade policies, so we can't make a missile here anymore. So we had to buy the parts from communist China. Who cares?
We lost 2 million manufacturing jobs in the last 2 years alone, 10% of our workforce. Walmart has replaced General Motors as the major employer in America, paying people starvation wages rather than living wages, and all of that does not matter to you. Doesn't matter if it's produced in China, where workers are making 30 cents an hour, or produced in Vermont, where workers can make 20 bucks an hour. It doesn't matter. You have told the American people that you support a trade policy which is selling them out, only working for the CEOs who can take our plants to China, Mexico, and India. You insulted Mr. Castle. Mr. Castle, a few moments ago, a good Republican, told you that we're seeing not only the decline of manufacturing jobs, but white-collar information technology jobs. Forrester Research says that over the next 15 years, 3.3 million U.S. service industry jobs and $136 billion in wages will move offshore to India, Russia, China, and the Philippines. Does any of this matter to you? Do you give one whit of concern to the middle class and working families of this country? That's my question.
And Greenspan composes himself and then begins.
Congressman, we have the highest standard of living in the world.
No, we do not. You go to Scandinavia and you will find that people have a much higher standard of living in terms of education, health care, and decent paying jobs.
And this is where Greenspan says, no, for a country our size... In other words, it's like you'll just get it.
Wrong, Mr. Greenspan.
May I answer your question?
You sure may.
Thank you. For a major industrial country, we have created the most advanced technologies, the highest standard of living for a country of our size.
In other words, the smaller ones that are doing better, they must do the best for their size. The larger ones, like, China, that are doing better, they've got something different. But, for our size, it's...
Economic growth is crucial to us. The incomes, the purchasing power of our employees, our workers, our people, are by far more important than what it is we produce.
Oh, so what we produce is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. We don't have to worry about national security considerations. We don't have to worry about the quality of whether or not we still make clothing in America. We don't have to worry about whether or not we still have technology. It just doesn't matter.
I submit to you that, may I?
Bernie's rolling his eyes.
The major focus of monetary policy is to create an environment in this country which enables capital investment and innovation to advance. We are at the cutting edge of technologies in the world. We are doing an extraordinary job over the years, and people flock to the United States. Our immigration rates are very high, and why? Because they think this is a wonderful country to come
to. That is an incredible answer.
Mr. Yeah. Paul?
Enough of that. And then they say, okay, Bernie, you've said your piece. No more. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Paula in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Paula.
Hi, Tom. I was actually calling to talk about taxes and the government.
Right.
But when you guys were talking about the robber baron age, I think both of you left out something. Have you ever read Kevin Phillips' Wealth and Democracy?
It's been a while.
Well, he talks about how the federal government, like, made these millionaires. Once the Civil War made a lot of millionaires because of selling arms and stuff.
Right, in particular the railroads.
And then don't forget the railroads, which were given massive amounts of public land.
Over 140 million acres of land.
So Well, that's what I actually was going to call about, is I was brought up a good liberal, and I believed in paying my taxes for the common good, and I believed in, you know, parks and schools and libraries. Never did believe in roads, because I grew up in L.A., and that was destroyed,
yeah.
You know, absolutely destroyed by the federal government policy.
No, actually, it was destroyed by a criminal conspiracy between General Motors and Firestone, for which they were convicted and paid a fine. They went
$1
in,
each. I know that.
Okay, you know the story.
The federal government is the one that paid for the roads that replaced the public trolleys.
Sure.
My mom, when she was little, she could go from L.A. to Long Beach for the day, you know, for 5 cents or whatever on the trolley, but whatever. In the meantime, I've started becoming more, since the Bush junta took over, it's like they're looting the public treasury, and we're hanging on to this idea of the common good. We're hanging on to this idea, and the shell has been hollowed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I believe in national parks. Oh, my God, I love them. Yellowstone and all the rest of them, you know, Grand Tetons. But what our taxes now are going for is to build roads to destroy these parks, you know, and the schools. I believe in the public schools. Yes, we should educate every kid, but instead our money's going for this, you know, No Child Left Behind.
We've gone away from anything that resembles democracy, at least the Bush administration has, and they've gone towards cronyism, essentially, oligarchy. Exactly. You're right. It's the robber barons all over again, only this time the robber barons are in charge of the government itself. And
right,
it's
irate about paying my taxes, watching him jet around on Air Force One trying to take away Social Security. I'm paying for all that fuel with my taxes, so now I'm getting irate.
That's why it's important, Paula. I'm sorry, but we're out of time here. That's why it's important for you to get out there and get politically active. We have to elect people that we can trust if we're going to have a functional democracy. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We say we build democracy, but really build refineries and drill for our prosperity from oil in the ground.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Melissa in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Melissa, welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I just wanted to make a comment about the gentleman who was talking about public education. It's my belief that we have no better defense for our country than to make sure that our people are well educated, if only to vote the idiots out that are misusing our taxes.
Yeah, and this is the reason why, number one, we need to make a greater investment in public education, because we have been it's been deteriorating for the better part of 25 years, ever since the conservatives started attacking it. And number two, we need to go back to the system that we had that Thomas Jefferson first put in place with the University of Virginia of free or extremely inexpensive public state schools, public colleges. The public college university system and the land-grant university system, schools like Michigan State University, college, certainly the University of California, used to be, no matter what your station in life was, if you had the intellectual capacity to do it, you could go to college. And even as Ronald Reagan was taking apart the University of California when I was a teenager, you know, Louise and I, we worked our way through college because, in fact, Louise worked her way through college working as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's, and we were able to do that because back then colleges were subsidized to the point where, and most of them were nonprofits, by the way, to the point where on, you know, just a, you know, a waitress salary, as it were, or, you know, basics, you know, I was working in radio making almost nothing. I think I was, you know, $6 an hour or something. Mm-hmm. You could put yourself through school.
Right.
I went to a
private school in Washington myself around that same period of time, and what it cost me then is what our public colleges cost now.
Yeah.
It's just absurd.
Yeah, it really is. And education is the strongest defender of democracy, the bottom
Absolutely.
Line. And as Thomas Jefferson pointed out over and over in so many different ways, if you want to have democracy, you must have an educated populace. Melissa, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, Washington
D.C. is in theory quiet, but of course everybody's waiting for the next Supreme Court justice nominee, which won't happen this today or this weekend. It's not going to happen until next week.
I think they're going to milk this thing until the news turns bad on them. They're going to keep the spin going, keep the speculation going, keep the focus on this instead of something else. And then when, you know, some shoe drops, whether it's the indictment of Karl Rove or whether it's chaos in Iraq or whatever, then they're going to trot out the nomination to seize the I mean, this is a huge PR tool that they've got to seize the news cycle.
Yes, it is. No, they certainly have. And even with Judith Miller coming out of prison and all the bad publicity they're getting about that, it's very interesting. One of our reporters was at the White House gaggle this morning and told me that there were only a couple of questions that came up about the Valerie Plame leak, and nearly all the questions were about the Chief Justice.
Yeah, I think the White House figures that story has already played itself out. Everybody knows that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby are traitors. I mean, people have figured that out. You know, the question is whether or not they're going to be indicted. But, you know, if some bad news comes down the road, you know, if Kathleen Blanco finally comes out and says, you know, this guy committed perjury under oath, you know, Michael Brown, you know, let's, you know, et cetera, you know, something like that. If something like that comes out, because they already know who they're going to nominate.
Absolutely, they know who they're going to nominate. I think they've known for some time who they're going to nominate. They've probably got a number three on the list in case John Paul Stevens decides to go, or Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah.
I think they have quite a long laundry list of people who they're interested in. But that you're right. They do want to milk this for as long as they can. They clearly decided that, look, let's give Roberts the spotlight. Let's give him the spotlight on Monday. He has an investiture. You know, he has the first day of arguments. Let's milk that. Don't go with the weekend news cycle. It's too risky. And anyway, CNN's big feature tonight is on a whole load of pets that were shot down in Hurricane Katrina land.
Mm. Okay.
It's actually a truly horrible story.
Yeah.
Truly horrible story.
Yeah. And the sort of thing the White House just loves, because it's not about the corruption of Tom DeLay. It's not about the corruption of Roy Blunt. It's not about the corruption of the Bush administration. It's about some dog that got shot.
But if it turns out that it was feds who shot the dogs, I can assure you that this reporter will be asking about it on Monday.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
Because, you know, you and I, Tom, and the animals... Even with cats, I know our cats would object to having other pets shot.
Yeah, no, I think all of us. I mean, you know, we have pets. Any caring human being would be concerned about that. Although it continually baffles me how people can have pets and be so concerned about them and then go to the store and eat a cow. But that's a whole other discussion.
It is another discussion, but it's definitely a good one. But really, Washington is abuzz with the Judith Miller story. It's the kind of thing that they love. She's a very divisive figure. Some people say that she stood up for her First Amendment right. Other people say that she had other things to hide.
I'm of the opinion she just was taking her opportunity to be a star. This,
I think you're right.
You know, she, because apparently Scooter Libby told her a long time ago, you know, don't worry. You know, you can leave, but I think that she decided when she was going to go in and when she was going to get out, and it seemed probably to her like the news cycle. I mean, I'm sounding very cynical here, but when it comes to Judith Miller, I am very cynical. She's one of the main reasons that we attacked Iraq. She was the one who was flogging that story in the New York Times and sending wrong information to the American people.
It's going to be very interesting to see what she does next in terms of whether she's going to write about this, or does she get the book deal, or what does she do?
Yeah, well, I don't think that that's an if.
No, I think it's a when.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. You know, it's funny because the right-wing talking points are probably going to be very similar. Oh, you know, Judith Miller, when does she get the book deal? She's part of the liberal media. And I'm saying, no, she's part of the conservative media. It was her articles in the New York Times that said that there were weapons of mass destruction. She was quoting Chalabi. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. The last hour, the last day of the week. Here are best of the rest of the news segment. We have David Sirota and Melanie Sloan with us. David Sirota is the co-chairman of the Progressive Legislative Action Network and blogs at sirotablog.com. progressivestates.org as well. Melanie Sloan, the executive director of Citizens for Ethics, citizensforethics.org. And David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Melanie, great to have you here, too.
Pleasure to be here.
It's great having you both. Melanie, also we've got a few callers here. We can if it's okay with the two of you, we can take a few callers and I'll give those some of their topics an opportunity for both of you to bounce off of them as well. But first, the question that I have for each of you, and I'll start by asking you, Melanie, what do you think it was the biggest story of this week, or perhaps the most even underreported story? What is the story that a year from now will still have really significant consequences?
I think those are sort of a couple different questions. Clearly,
sure.
The biggest story this week was Tom DeLay's indictment. The second biggest story would be that Senator Frist, the majority leader of the Senate, is under criminal investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York and by the SEC. This is really an unhappy, historic first to have both majority leaders under criminal investigation at the same time. I think the story that today is still being overlooked is that the new House Majority Leader, Roy Blunt, is also quite corrupt. So it doesn't seem that the House particularly has learned anything at all about the need for ethical leadership.
Well, it's getting increasingly difficult to find a Republican who's not corrupt, is it not?
It is getting increasingly difficult, but, you know, there are some out there.
There are a few, yeah. You know, I had a strange theory about Bill Frist. Bill Frist comes out and speaks up against George W. Bush, basically. I'm sure Bush took it personally with the stem cell thing. And Bush has this mentality, which is probably the best example of it is this famous saying. Here he is.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
It's like, you know, it's all black and white. You're either a friend of George or you're not. And Frist in that moment became not a friend of George. And then right after that happened, or, you know, maybe a week or so after that, you started seeing all these stories in the right-wing media about how Bill Frist's Hospital Corporation of America was one of the nation's largest abortion providers. And which, of course, doesn't play well with the base that Frist wants to go to if he decides to run for president, which he's, you know, pretty clear that he wants to do. And so I was wondering if that was the reason why he dumped his HCA stock, and maybe the timing was just coincidental and bad, and now the administration is punishing him even, and that it might have been Karl Rove who was doing those leaks, and now the administration is double punishing him by sicking the SEC on him. Basically, they're trashing him because he dared to stand up to Bush. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't put it past them. Certainly, it seems pretty, you know, like I would believe any bad thing out of the Bush administration, especially Karl Rove. It seems, however, more likely that Bill Frist, his brother, is still on the board of HCA, and the stock was about to drop precipitously, and so he sold. And then he's come up with this conflict of interest story, which is a strange story for Dr. Frist to be providing, given that for the past 12 years he's found absolutely no conflict of interest in owning that stock.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Melanie Sloan with citizensforethics.org. David Sirota, progressivestates.org. Hey, David.
How are you?
Great, great. What do you see as the biggest stories of this last week?
Well, I obviously think that the Frist and the DeLay thing are very big in the short and midterm sort of time frame. I think the biggest story, however, if we're talking about what stories are going to really affect Americans over the next, you know, many years, is the confirmation of John Roberts as the you know, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I think that's going to have long-lasting implications on women's rights, civil rights, corporate power issues, all sorts of issues that go through our court system. In terms of underreported, I think there's probably two things that were really underreported. I think one is that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take a case dealing with Daimler Chrysler, which basically could invalidate and make essentially unconstitutional tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of corporate subsidies that state and local governments give to already wealthy corporations. If that case actually goes through and is upheld, it would
be a major shift in public policy and in how taxpayer dollars are used. I think the other underreported story is that there was a national poll that came out that showed that 4 in 5 Americans, including 76% of Republicans, support an immediate enactment of a windfall profits tax on oil companies. You're not hearing anybody talking about that poll. You've got, you know, a couple of Democrats who support that idea, but, you know, here's the public screaming out for action, and, you know, it doesn't even make a blip on the in terms of breaking through in the mainstream media.
It's true. It was similarly with regard to the Tom DeLay thing. Media Matters did a great job on this today about how the mainstream media is basically not telling Ronnie Earl's side of the story. They're just spin, you know, putting out the Tom DeLay spin. And it's just the so-called liberal media is pretty unliberal. But getting back to the Daimler Chrysler story, I'm seeing this a trend in both federal judicial appointments and certainly Bush's appointments so far, his one to the Supreme Court, of not just moving toward people who are, quote, conservative, end quote, but toward people who are overtly corporatist.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And that was the big travesty of the Roberts confirmation process. That his career, or should I say, the fact that he had his major experience was serving as essentially defending corporate abusers and corporate criminals, that was really not part of much part of the confirmation process.
At $1 million a year as a salary he was making as a hired gun for big corporations.
Exactly. I mean, you had the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and all these business groups pushing him. They know that the Supreme Court is increasingly dealing with these issues dealing with corporate power, and they know and they wanted somebody on there who would go to bat for them, and they got it. And that was never a part of the debate, and that's really a shame.
The other thing that surprised me was we now, Danny Schechter published photos from the videotape of, you know, when John Bolton and Tom DeLay's entire congressional staff showed up down in Florida in 2000 and were pounding on the windows screaming, stop the vote, stop the vote. There was John Roberts.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
a photo of John Roberts. That was never mentioned. And
no,
and in fact, what's really interesting, I had Senator Maria Cantwell on the radio program, and this was a few days ago. In fact, the day before she announced she was going to vote against Roberts, and she was talking about kind of like she was leaning towards him. It was the sense I got of it. And I said, well, what do you think about the fact that he was the guy who went down to Florida and advised Jeb Bush how to prevent the Democrats from suing the state to hold up the electors, and he was the guy who coached the Bush team that was going to argue before the Supreme Court. He played the role of Rehnquist. And she was like, you're kidding.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'm like, no. And you didn't know this? You're a United States senator? She's like, no, I didn't know this. And I was talking with Mark Miller the other day, Mark Crispin Miller, and he said he had a similar conversation with John Conyers where he was talking about the Republican alignment of the voting machine corporations. And John Conyers' response was, you're kidding. I didn't know that. We had to hold hearings on this. And we were talking about, you know, we need to invent or create a publication, sort of like The Hill, an insider publication for Washington, D.C., that talks about these kind of issues, because apparently the congressional stabs are not doing their jobs.
Yeah, well, and of course, what did we hear? What was the subject of the debate? The debate was that John Roberts wasn't really a quote-unquote ideological nominee, which is basically a bunch of malarkey. I mean, the guy, if you look down his record, he is an ideological conservative foot soldier. Now, if the debate had centered around that, and the Congress and the public was informed of that, and he still got confirmed, you know, that's a whole separate story. But essentially, the big story is the fact that we had a debate over the single most important legal position in America that basically left the public and the Congress completely in the dark.
Yeah, and then I had Ron Wyden on day before yesterday, and he's like, well, you know, the Republicans swallowed really hard to take a partisan like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I said, what made her partisan? She was never involved in party politics. And he's like, well, she was the head of the ACLU. And I said, she wasn't the head of the ACLU. She was a lawyer for the ACLU. And he says, well, you know, same thing, she was the head lawyer for them. And I said, that's not a partisan organization.
Right.
You know,
I mean,
yeah, Bob Barr, who I used to drink beer with in Atlanta, Georgia, is as right wing as you can get. He was trying to take down Bill Clinton. The guy is, in my opinion, at the time, I thought, you know, this guy's incredibly toxic. We'd have, you know, shouting matches. But he, you know, Bob Barr's on the board. I mean, this has got nothing to do with politics. And Ron Wyden is like, well, no, it's a political organization. And it's like, give me a break.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this Melanie Sloan, on the whole John Roberts thing.
Well, I have to say I didn't know about the picture, and I'm quite shocked, and I think that would have changed an awful lot of people's minds had they known it. I feel quite certain that the senators and the Senate Judiciary Committee and in the whole Senate, a lot of them must not have known this when they voted.
But it was in the news media like a month ago that Roberts was the guy who went down there on his own nickel and advised Jeb Bush. He was Jeb Bush's first lawyer on how to keep the vote from being counted. And that he had counseled the Bush team on how to go before the Supreme Court. I believe, David, correct me if I'm wrong, was this not in the New York Times?
I believe it was. I mean, here's the thing that we should all be worried about. You know, a lot of the Democrats on the Roberts nomination said that, you know, when they finally voted for him, they said, well, you know, we're really going to stand up if they nominate somebody who's an arch conservative to fill Sandra Day O'Connor's position, because the idea is that if you replace her with an arch conservative, you switch the whole balance of the court. But here's what we should worry about. Everyone's trying to forget that when Roberts was originally the nominee slated to replace O'Connor and Rehnquist was still alive, many Democrats said, we're going to vote for him anyway. He's going to pass. So they
I know.
Standing up for him.
I know. It's truly scary. And Melanie, you really illustrate the point, because, you know, I'm saying, you know, it was in the New York Times, but it was buried. I mean, it was just, I can't say that I'm sure that it was even in the New York Times. I know it was in the media, but great point. We're talking with Melanie Sloan, citizensforethics.org, David Sirota, progressivestates.org. We'll take your calls, and we'll be right back with both of them just after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Her newborn baby's wailing like a moaning dove. An old man with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Yeah, it's something we could use right now, a little shelter from the storm of the bushies. Welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. We're talking with Melanie Sloan of Citizens for Ethics, citizensforethics.org, and David Sirota, progressivestates.org. And welcome back. Let's take a you're both still here, right?
Yep.
Hey, Melanie and David. Charisse, and how do you pronounce your city, Charisse?
Paulsboro,
Washington is on the line.
Yeah.
Hey, Charisse, you had a question, comment?
Yeah. On Lou Dobbs, he's always ranting about illegal immigrants and everything, which is a great topic. And he's talking about how these big corporations that are going to do the rebuilding in the Gulf Coast are bringing in all sorts of illegal immigrants since the Davis-Bacon thing is lifted to do the work. And with everyone complaining about how we're going to pay for it, I don't understand why congressmen aren't screaming that if these companies were forced to use American citizens, which they should do anyway to do the rebuilding, we'd have payroll taxes, we'd have income taxes, and that money would stay here in the United States and be spent here and boost our economy. Instead, they're saying that at least $20 billion of the reconstruction money will go straight across the border to boost Mexico's economy.
Melanie Sloan, your thoughts on that? Is that an area that your organization gets into?
It's not really an area we covered, so I guess I'd defer to David.
Okay, David, take a shot at it.
Well, I think you're at, you know, the idea of illegal immigration is a really important topic. I think you're absolutely right that the Davis-Bacon law has really opened up the region down there to all sorts of abuse. I mean, the fact is, repealing a law like that basically allows basically is a green light to corporations to do whatever they want to do to basically use the disaster to maximize their profits. So I'm not surprised to hear what the caller's talking about, and you know, but I think it's in the bigger picture of all sorts of abuse going on down there. I mean, you've got no bid contracts flowing to, you know, President Bush's former campaign manager, and now you've got this new wage law that allows those same companies that are taking taxpayer cash to drive down workers' wages. It is a mess.
And they can even incorporate offshore, so they don't have to pay any U.S.
Right.
income taxes. My take on the whole immigration, illegal immigration thing, we have this weird reality of roughly 10% of the entire gross domestic product of Mexico is money going back to Mexico from illegal immigrants in the United States working. And people go, oh, well, we need to defend the border. We need to have, you know, vigilantes or whatever. We need to put up a wall. We need to do like Israel's doing, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I, you have to ask the question, well, you know, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, there was no wall down there, and we didn't have illegal immigrant labor all over the place. What's different between then and now? I mean, the borders were much more porous then, and we weren't having an invasion of Mexicans and whatnot. And it seems to me that what was different was that we had a strong labor movement back then. We had a strong middle class back then, and that the labor movement was the first barrier to entry into the workforce, and therefore that's been, you know, I mean, we 25% of America's labor force was unionized. 50% of Americans were earning a union wage in 1980. When Ronald Reagan came into power and declared war on organized labor. Now we're down to 8% of the private labor force is unionized. And so that one of those major protections is gone.
I think the other piece is that we have a trade policy right now which essentially encourages a giant race to the bottom. I mean, we've got this quote-unquote free trade policy allows corporations to push wages, environmental standards, labor standards further and further down to create desperate situations in developing countries all over the world, including Mexico. When you do that, you create this huge amount of pressure on the populations of these countries to do whatever it takes to better their situation. I think that's why you have more pressure on our border.
Yeah, although there's always been terrible poverty in Mexico. I mean, I've worked in Mexico back in the 60s, and it was pretty grim down there then, particularly Mexico City. But the big difference is that my take on it, for what it's worth, is that if we were to pass a law, or start enforcing the laws, actually, you know, right now, that any CEO who hires any illegal immigrants has to, you know, 1 year in jail, not negotiable, period, and it automatically gets enforced, that you'd have 10 million illegal aliens standing at the Mexican border trying to get back into Mexico tomorrow morning because there's no work for them.
Yeah, well, good luck getting that legislation passed. There was a similar piece of legislation last Congress which would have made CEOs legally liable if the IRS found that the company had cheated on its taxes. That was added to a conference committee bill, and it was stripped out in the last minute. So,
yeah,
you know.
And instead, and unfortunately, what happens is the racists are demagoguing this thing. There's a huge chunk of racial demagoguery around illegal immigration, and the nationalists are demagoguing this thing. And really, I think what it comes down to is economic policy. Melanie Sloan with Citizens for Ethics and Government, your organization, you produced a report this week, did you not?
Yes, we did. It's called Beyond Delay, the 13 Most Corrupt Members of Congress.
Yeah, and I thought that was really cool. And Roy Blunt was right up there toward the top of the list, as I recall. I don't have it right in front of me.
Yes, well, it happens that they were in alphabetical order.
Aha! Therefore, okay. So tell us.
Roy Blunt does have a lot of ethics things that people should be concerned about.
Yeah, so tell us about the most corrupt. I was surprised, frankly, to see Maxine Waters on there. I think she was the lone Democrat. But this whole issue of corruption in government, we just have about 10, 15 seconds here if you want to give us just a sample of that.
You know, the big problem now is that neither the Senate nor the House Ethics Committee is working in any way, shape, or form. The Congress doesn't take the issue of ethics seriously, and until the public starts insisting that they do, I think we're going to be at a standstill, and congressmen are going to feel free to do whatever they want.
Okay, well said. And it is these are serious problems right across the board. Melanie Sloan, citizensforethics.org, David Sirota, progressivestates.org. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Great organizations. Check them out. Thank you for listening today. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for dropping by, tomhartman.com. If you want to get into our live chat room, thanks to Louise and David Poole for producing our program this week. Thanks to Mike Toth for putting up our archives on the website. Thanks to Shelby and Ben for streaming us at radiopower.org, White Rose Society, the folks at Air America Radio for distributing the program, the folks at Jones. See you next week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.